Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations, 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report, Deadly Medicine, when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. The federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. That's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. Now, closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. Each and every system contained between 2 and 10 million records. And all of this information about you and me is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and very logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources, and how is it stored, and how is it retrieved? What do they want it for, anyway? Well, knowing how this information is gathered, and what information is stored, and what information you want to keep personal and private, actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Just ask for the free general law CD package, and I'll tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. All you have to do is call that number, 417-273-4967, to order yours. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and just send an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about Chapter 2 in the book called Deadly Medicine. What's really going on here in Chapter 2 is the classic practice of witchcraft. Remember, as we were discussing, or we were reading, the fellow that's doing the research, Eldon Bennett, who discovered Tambacore, is cooking this product down. He's taking raw materials. In this case, he's just taking chemicals. But we do it in a number of other ways. For instance, we practice witchcraft with an ordinary herb called tobacco. And we take the tobacco, and we cure it, and then we roll it, and then we light a match to it, and then we inhale the fumes that come off of it. We call this smoking. And what we're really after is the active ingredient in the tobacco called nicotine, and we want to use that nicotine as a drug, and the cigarette is the drug transfer agent. Now, we can take an ordinary herb that God gave us called tobacco, and we can practice witchcraft, synthesize down the nicotine, absorb it into our bloodstream, and we will get a chemical effect. We'll have an effect on the body. We can do this ordinary herb with cocoa. You know, you can take the cocoa leaf and you can chew it. It's an ordinary herb. And it's a food or medicine. Then you can take that same ordinary herb and you can cook it and rend it, and you can take the active ingredient cocaine and you can synthesize it down until you have crack, and then you've created a drug. Now, drugs and the use of drugs is called witchcraft in the Bible, punishable by death. It's not something that God approves of. And we do this commonly. And the process that's being described here in Chapter 2 of Thomas J. Moore's book called Deadly Medicine is simply the practice of what's known in the Bible as the art of the apothecary. And we do it very commonly with such common things as sugar and sugar cane, or beets and sugar beets, and we boil it and we cook it and we synthesize it down because we're after the sugar crystal. And then we can put that into our Coca-Cola, and then we can mainline the stuff. You see, you can't get enough of this sugar to cause your body any harm or damage when you eat it naturally. But we can synthesize it down until we can get 9 to 12 teaspoons of sugar in a can of pop. We can drink that can of pop, which is 4 times more than your body can handle. You get a chemical reaction in your body. You like the chemical reaction. It gives your children ADHD, and then you can give them Ritalin to calm them down. So you can boost them up with sugar, and then you can calm them down with Ritalin. And this is called drugs. Let's carry the story a little further. The author, Thomas J. Moore, wrote the book Deadly Medicine, Why Tens of Thousands of Heart Patients Died in America's Worst Drug Disaster. The story begins with a new heart drug created in the research laboratories of 3M Company. In animals, this drug appears unusually effective in suppressing irregular heartbeats. Hoping for a blockbuster, 3M launches the clinical tests in humans and plans how to seize the market from competing companies. But as medical researchers test Tambacor, as the drug is called, the first signs of potential trouble began to appear. At Stanford University, a doctor warns that this type of powerful drug may be dangerous. Other experiments fail to demonstrate the expected benefits of such drugs. But with the support of their clinical doctors and with millions of dollars invested in Tambacor, 3M moves ahead and seeks approval from the FDA. Other companies also followed suit with similar drugs. Now, questions about the safety of Tambacor have already reached the medical review staff at the FDA in Washington, D.C., where a behind-the-scenes drama begins to take place. 3M presses for approval of Tambacor, while the FDA staff tries to interpret the meaning of reports that some patients who have taken the drug suddenly drop dead. Now, without a green light from the FDA, Tambacor may be doomed. And the final chapters in the story unfold as 3M gets to the marketplace and, using all of the skills of modern pharmacological manufacture, persuades doctors to use Tambacor. At the same time, an important clinical trial begins. The National Institutes of Health launched an experiment with more than 1,000 patients to measure the benefits of Tambacor. And two similar drugs, one was called Encade, and another one that I can't pronounce. And the shocking results of the study and the response of the doctors and the companies who promoted these drugs bring this tragedy to a powerful conclusion. Now, the book is published by Simon & Schuster. It was published back in 1995. So you may have a problem finding the book. Go to your used bookstore and have a look it up online, and they'll find you a copy. Remember, it's Deadly Medicine, Thomas J. Moore. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. And it fits right in with this drug called Vioxx, which has just been pulled off the market by Merck. It also causes heart trouble. But keep in mind, when God told us that the penalty for witchcraft was death, he wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat. You don't have to be burning these people at the stake or stoning them to death. These people, even by themselves, and all of the people that take and use these products, kill themselves. And the people that were using Tambacor were practicing witchcraft, using the art of the apothecary. And it kills 130,000 people a year. And that's by government's own admission, 130,000. That's what Bill Clinton, our former president, reported to us. In this story, they say that it's probably more like 160 or 70,000 people a year. Government likes to keep the numbers low so as not to shock you. Well, the fellow who discovered Tambacor was what we call in the Bible a wizard. His name was Eldon Bennett. And in this chapter 2, we discovered that he was cooking and synthesizing and filtering and doing all those things that we call making the witch's brew. Well, listen to this. A powerful but simple way to think about this problem, that is, the problem of synthesizing these chemicals down into the kind of drug that we want, was devised nearly a century ago by one of the great pioneers of pharmacology. He was a German scientist by the name of Paul Ehrlich, and long before anyone else had a clear idea of the inner workings of the cells, Ehrlich theorized that cells must have receptors, and that all drugs did was to react with a unique cellular receptor. Well, the easy way to visualize this is to imagine that your cell in your body, a cell, has a receptor. It's like a lock, and the drug is the key, and some drugs work like a kind of skeleton key. They turn to locks all over your body. Others would work in only one lock, affecting just one very narrow function, such as the absorption of sugar from the bloodstream. We call that insulin. Well, decades of scientific progress produced abundant specific examples to validate Ehrlich's theory. The outer membrane of every cell is packed with special receptors that recognize molecules of a particular size and shape. Receptors also float in the fluid inside of your cell, and still others lurk in the cell nucleus, ready to restrain or unleash some process described in the genetic code of your DNA. In modern pharmaceutical research and development, it is increasingly possible to create idealized pictures of the cell receptors and then to fashion a molecule with a matching shape. But in the late 60s and early 70s, when Eldon Bennett was working in his 3M laboratory, the process was less deliberate, and he made a whole bunch of keys with new shapes and then tried them in a lot of different locks. This was why about 10,000 novel compounds had to be tested to come up with just one drug. Many medicinal chemists work a lifetime creating these new molecules, and they never make a winner. They never find that new drug. But one day, Bennett's starting point was a white powder called salicylic acid. $10 will buy several pounds of it at any chemical supply house. And this cheap chemical boasts a rich history. It's the active ingredient in the willow bark prescribed by physicians back as far as Hippocrates. Now, a simple alteration of this molecule yields a vastly more pleasant-tasting compound called aspirin, one of the most beneficial medicines ever discovered. However, Bennett was not interested in a new kind of aspirin. Salicylic acid was merely a convenient molecule built on a central structure containing the benzene ring of six carbon molecules. Bennett discovered the salicylic acid in a common solvent called acetone. Next, Bennett concocted a second chemical brew. It was rich in an element with which unusual properties that it formed the central focus of a special research program at 3M. That element was called fluorine. Now, 3M already had created numerous products through skillful manipulation of the fluorine atoms. One was its Scotch Guard treatment to protect fabrics from grease stains. Fluorine would become the key ingredient in the linings of microwave popcorn bags. It protected hoses in automobile engines, and it was an important constituent in the blankets of foam sprayed to quench aircraft and oil fires. Now, the company considered itself a master of fluorine chemistry, and it was now trying to apply this expertise in pharmaceuticals. This scientific cross-fertilization was the hallmark of the technical innovation that 3M systematically nurtured as its commercial lifeblood. The key components in Bennett's second chemical mixture were three fluorine atoms clamped to a carbon atom. Fluorine is interesting because it is so similar to, but also subtly different from, the ubiquitous element called hydrogen. With a single proton and a single electron, hydrogen is ready to attach itself almost anywhere, anywhere that a vacant electron orbit offers a safe harbor. But lightweight hydrogen is also readily detached, and it's lured away to some more powerful mate. So even with its nine protons and electrons, fluorine has almost the same propensity as hydrogen to combine readily with many other atoms. However, unlike the easily detached hydrogen atom, fluorine clings more tightly in place. So fluorine yields a more stable compound. Stability was an attractive property for a drug. For oral administration, a drug had to survive being bathed in stomach acid, and it must resist the assault of digestive juices, and it has to be protected against the liver enzymes that divide large molecules into smaller pieces. Fluorine had other valuable properties as well. Bennett's carbon and three fluorine atoms were at the moment part of a much more elaborate sulfur compound. It's a nasty white powder with the chemical name of 222. This can, too, be brought readily from a chemical supply house. Now came a critical part of the medicinal chemist's art. Bennett had to engineer a chemical reaction in which the cluster of carbon and three fluorine atoms was removed from the sulfur compound, and then it has to be reattached to the benzene ring exactly where he intended. To achieve this, the sulfur and fluorine compound was dissolved in the acetone along with a third agent called potassium carbonate. Now came the first major step in making this new molecule. Very, very slowly, the salicylic acid mixture was stirred into the heated fluorine-rich brew. It took 2 full hours of slow, patient work just to combine these two mixtures. Then to complete the chemical reaction, for the 40 ounces of liquid and dissolved chemicals required 24 continuous hours of boiling. To avoid the obvious problem that it soon would boil dry, Bennett used a condenser tube to capture the escaping vapors and then cool them to a liquid and then drain them back into the flask. After 24 hours, this hot mixture was filtered and the liquid removed by evaporation. The residue was a thick yellow syrup. Bennett still had to purify this mixture to remove all of the remaining original agents and its byproducts. To do so, he used a paper filter to remove some impurities, and others were dissolved in chloroform and then evaporated step by step, and he removed all of the other compounds until only this new chemical remained. Bennett was still not done. To this first product, he attached a nitrogen atom to the benzene ring, and then nitrogen, in turn, acquired a side chain, which was then stripped away from the other molecules. Eldon Bennett now had a finished new molecule of his own design, but once again, he faced many laborious steps to extract this new molecule from his mixture and then turn them into crystals. And as a final step, he would send out the new crystals for tests to confirm the compound's molecular weight and its basic structure. Now, this is the very scientific art of witchcraft. It's the apothecary of ancient times' wildest dream that he could actually take the very basic building blocks of the universe and then mold them and create them into a chemical brew, as Bennett has done. Now, what happened next, when a new molecular structure was finally at hand, it reveals much about the development of these new drugs. Bennett put the white crystals, just a meager handful of white powder, into an amber medicine bottle. Then he labeled the bottle with a diagram of this new chemical structure that he had just created. Then he started all over again. Next time, the fluorine group would be moved to a different position on the hexagon of carbon molecules. And sometimes he attached two fluorine groups, and the side chain sprouted from the nitrogen, and it would have different shapes and lengths. And he changed the reactants, and he experimented with different chemical techniques. And these acts of creation were too prosaic to deserve a name. They just got a number, beginning in 1966 with the number R1. Years later, the number was R799 that Eldon Bennett really hit pay dirt. It was number 799. And before Bennett reached 799, a fortuitous event affected this entire course of the research project. One original goal was to find a new, but better anesthetic. Bennett had started with a prototype molecule with properties of an anesthetic, and then he developed interesting variants. One prototype molecule was called procainamide. It's a relative of the first local anesthetic, Novocaine. And what happened next was exactly what is envisioned in business school textbooks about managing innovation. Well, one day, a 3M pharmacologist by the name of Jack Schmid had a bright idea. As a pharmacologist, he specialized in understanding how molecules functioned as a medicine and how they were absorbed into the bloodstream of the body, what dose should be used, and what their therapeutic effects and side effects would be. Schmid suggested that some of the would-be anesthetics that Bennett had created might work as an anti-arrhythmic drug for people with irregular heartbeats. So two leading anti-arrhythmic drugs called procainamide and lidocaine were both local anesthetics. Equally important was the mechanism by which they achieved their pain-deadening effect. Nerve cells transmit signals of pain through electrical impulses that ripple in waves along the cell membranes, leaping from one fiber to the next fiber. The two local anesthetics altered this electrical property of the nerve cells, slowing the conduction of these electrical pulses, so much, in fact, that the pain signal was not propagated from cell to cell. Now, in the human heart, similar waves of electrical pulses trigger the contraction. Perhaps a drug that slows conduction might help. For instance, that patient of Roger Winkle's, who had an electrical short circuit that created a heartbeat that was so rapid that it soon killed him. Well, thanks to Schmidt's idea, Eldon Bennett had an entirely new potential for use in this series of new fluorine compounds. So now the problem was finding whether or not any of them actually worked. Now, in this critical screening phase, a lot depends on the disease process and what medical science knows about it. In well-characterized disorders, screening is a straightforward routine. If the goal is a drug to kill bacteria, each compound can be put on a petri dish where the bacteria grow. Then, the rare compounds that show activity can be given to mice to make sure that they don't kill them also. Then, at the other extreme, some biological processes are so poorly understood that it is difficult to devise any feasible screening test. So, for example, hidden among these hundreds of thousands of novel compounds that have already been created by the pharmaceutical industry, there might be several that greatly enhance conceptual thinking. But except in large-scale human tests, how would the experimenter know? And these large-scale human tests are slow and expensive to produce. But experimenting on a population at large is a whole lot cheaper and a whole lot more efficient. For many medical problems, an animal model is developed. There are inbred mice strains with no immune systems, which grow human tumors that are surgically implanted. Now, another mouse is prone to heart failure and provides a model for testing drugs to increase cardiac output. None of these animal models accurately reflects the disease process in humans, however. So, as a screen, the models produce a manageable number of possibilities. So, one reason that 3M decided to look for an antiarrhythmic drug was the existence of an animal model that had been well documented in the open scientific literature. And this is how that animal model worked. For each compound, the 3M team used 10 female Swiss Webster mice, an inbred laboratory strain. Each mouse was given a large oral dose of this test compound dissolved in water and gum arabic. Then the mice were placed in glass beakers. So the first test was elementary. If the drug was highly toxic, it simply killed the mice or it caused other easily observable harm. Next, a wad of cotton saturated with chloroform was added to the beaker, and as you might expect, the first effect was to put the mice to sleep. The anesthetic was so concentrated that the mice soon stopped breathing. So what happens next is provided, and it does provide the basis for the animal model. Soon after these mice stopped breathing, the physiological stress quickly led to a complete collapse of the electrical system of the mouse's heart. Now, under these circumstances, a mammal heart will continue beating even when it's removed from the body. But the stresses of this particular protocol in these mice caused an electrical breakdown, and the rhythmic, coordinated waves gave way to electrical chaos. So, individual cells contracted randomly, and they contracted spasmodically in the pattern called ventricular fibrillation. The anesthetized mouse was removed from the beaker, its chest was cut open, and a researcher could then observe if the mouse's heart was quivering chaotically in ventricular fibrillation. If so, that meant that the compound had had no effect on heart rhythms. Now, sometimes the researcher would observe a heart that was still pulsing with normal, but perhaps slowed contractions. Now, this was the first sign of a possible drug winner. Now, any compound that slowed antiarrhythmic activity was then tested again at half the dose in 10 more mice. This continued until the researcher established the lowest dose at which the chaotic pattern of ventricular fibrillation was prevented in at least half of the mice tested. Now, this lower dose, the lowering of the dose, the more potent the drug. Testing began with two well-known existing drugs called procainamide and quinidine. This benchmark then allowed the 3M team to match their own data with the results published in the scientific literature. Then, the comparison had another central purpose. A drug that didn't work better than the two drugs that are already on the market has very little interest because it has no commercial value. Bennett and his colleague, the pharmacologist Jack Schmid, well, they identified more than 20 fluorine compounds that didn't kill the mice and appeared at least as effective as quinidine. So the results allowed Bennett to graduate from a blind search for activity into a very targeted process of a designer drug. Now he could begin to see which specific molecular structures actually work. So Bennett learned that attaching two separate clusters of carbon and fluorine atoms worked a whole lot better than using just one. And the test results came when these two clusters were attached to the hexagon at carbon atom number 2 and carbon atom number 5. And it resulted in a drug 4 times as potent as quinidine. But Bennett was still the blind locksmith, and he was creating the key to turn an unknown switch off or on. Specifically, which cell receptor was involved and how it affected the function of cardiac muscle cells still remained a mystery. So the key that worked best in this mysterious lock was R799. Bennett experimented extensively with the side chain. The side chain on R799 was exactly like procainamide. It was a long chain, and it branched at the second nitrogen atom like a fork in a tree branch. So the team worried that the two branches of the side chain might have a serious disadvantage in a drug. A saleable, commercial, anti-arrhythmic drug needed to have a long life in the body. And these two branches of the side chain looked vulnerable to liver enzymes, which might sever them. So it was just possible the researchers might have a better drug by taking the ends of these two branches and then joining them to form a single ring. Several compounds were created with a side chain that terminated in this ring structure. One of these compounds was numbered R818, and it was very effective in mice, almost as good as the original leading candidate, R799. Two or three others worked nearly as well, and many were as good as or better than quinidine. Now the 3M team owned a collection of keys that without a doubt actually fit some very important locks. Well, at least as defined by the animal model. Now we needed some human experimentation. The perfect drug fits only the cell receptor of interest to the pharmacologist and no other. So unfortunately, there are no perfect drugs. So often they fit locks in unexpected locations, and this can be a bonanza to the researcher. A drug developed to combat motion sickness became very important in the treatment of severe mental disorders. Iprozanid, a drug used against tuberculosis, was later discovered to be an antidepressant when patients reported to their doctors that not only were their lungs better, they just felt terrific. But most often, when a drug fits too many different receptors, this causes unacceptable side effects. A terminal problem for uncounted numbers of otherwise promising drugs. So with R799 in the lead, the 3M development team began more extensive tests in animals. Dogs were given an intravenous infusion of Wybane, a paralytic agent once used in Zulu poison arrows, and a fast-acting form of the heart drug that we call Digitalis. In the toxic doses used, Cobain caused a whole spectrum of heart rhythm disturbances, ranging from occasional premature ventricular contractions to ventricular fibrillation, the total disorganization of the electrical system of the heart. Then the researchers measured how effectively the test drug prevented these rhythm disorders. In these and other animal models of increasing sophistication, R799 still looked more potent than any drug then on the market. But then one day R799 died. This is how most pharmacological research and development ends. While it was remarkably effective in all of the animal models used, it failed one critical test. You see, when it was administered to mice for a longer time, it proved to be too toxic to the central nervous system, and it killed the mice. That's just the kind of problem that you would expect from a potent drug, originally modeled on a local anesthetic, a deadener of nerves. So just a small handful of compounds remained. Fortunately, one of them was R818. Practically identical with R799, except for the curious ring shape at the end of its side chain. It was not quite as effective in the animal models as was R799, but it was 7 to 12 times more potent than any other drug on the market. So for the 3M team, that would ultimately prove to be good enough. And in time, R818 would become a drug to be called Tambacor. The year? 1972. and the development was just now beginning in earnest. 3M had been researching novel fluorine compounds for 6 years, and now it looked like they finally had a winner. All right, hang on. Let me give you a caveat here so that we can get the network and the stations off the hook in case you want to blame them for these crazy outlandish views. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, just go to the webpage georgegordon.org. The Law Hour offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, if you'd like to order one, just call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember, go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. All right, when Tamiflu finally was found to be killing people at 6 times the rate of the placebo, an outcry began to form. You know, that's what happened with Vioxx. When we find out that these drugs, when they're used in mass human tests, and remember this, there's no way to test these drugs and make them foolproof. I mean, to do that, we'd have to test this thing for 30 years on a select number of people, and we don't have that kind of time, effort, and energy. So what we do is we do the animal studies, and we write up these results, and we submit it to the FDA, and we tell the FDA that these drugs have great potential. And then with this animal study out of the way, we then move on to the human marketing, and we market it. And it'll work in humans because it works in animals. And then we monitor the humans for a long time. Now, this drug came out about 1972, but by 1990, you know, about 20 years later, we find out, hey, it's killing a lot of people. And it had been killing these people for 20 years. You know, kill a few people every year, and in 20 years it totals up to 50,000 people. And that's about as many people as died in the entire Vietnam War. And we're killing 130,000 people a year by government's own estimates by using these drugs on people in these human experiments. And so when you take drugs, when you practice witchcraft, you are a human guinea pig. Now, in announcing the CAST results immediately, remember this CAST study now has 1,400 human patients, and we're actually testing Tamiflu and NCAID to see if is it any more effective or is it any more dangerous than a placebo, just giving you sugar. So in announcing this CAST study result, Claude L'Enfant believed that he was fulfilling his duty as director of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. You see, he had allowed no delay at all in telling the public that too widely used drugs might cause cardiac arrest. CAST was also a scientific discovery on the first order. You see, at least half of America's physicians had assumed that they were preventing sudden death by suppressing premature beats and other wild rhythm disturbances. CAST provided clear evidence that this widespread medical treatment was, in fact, harmful. On either scientific or public health grounds, it would seem hard to fault his action. However, the intensity of the outcry from the medical community surprised even the veteran L'Enfant. Now get this. You see, you got a doctor, and he's prescribing this drug to you. And all of a sudden, here comes this news report that, hey, listen, Vioxx causes heart attack. Well, you know, you got millions of people out here taking Vioxx. Millions of people are out here consuming this product called Tamiflu. And they put this notice out without first publishing it in the scientific journals. So the doctors who are prescribing this stuff to you every day learned about its toxic effects the same day you did. Now listen to this. So without intending to, Claude L'Enfant, MD, had violated one of the most sacred unwritten rules in medicine, and that is, thou shalt not tell. You're not supposed to tell people about Vioxx. You're not supposed to tell them about Tamiflu. You publish it in the scientific journals, and then you let the doctors tell the patients so that nobody ever gets wise to what the hell's going on here. We don't want you lay people to get disturbed about being human guinea pigs, and we kill a few of you. Thou shalt not tell. Doctors do not reveal how frequently they harm their patients, even kill their patients. The shadowy outlines of the thou shalt not tell pledge can be seen in the adamant refusal of most physicians to testify in malpractice cases against their fellow physicians, no matter how great the negligence that may be involved. Thou shalt not tell explains why, as noted earlier, 168,000 people can die every year in hospital care accidents with so little being said about it. And the aggressive culture of can-do modern medicine, first do no harm, has now been quietly replaced by thou shalt not tell, and it was this rule that L'Enfant had broken. Now, a small but essential warning issued at the press conference that had the inadvertent effect of guaranteeing that thousands of doctors were going to get angry, very angry, and very soon. Among the 200,000 patients taking Tamiflu and NCAID, there was a small minority who indeed did have life-threatening rhythm disorders. mainly a sustained rapid heartbeat or ventricular tachycardia. And in some of these patients, the problem would recur if they halted their medication. And among these few patients, a recurrence could be life-threatening. Now, both Linfant and the FDA commissioner, his name was Frank Young, had anticipated this danger. So at the press conference, they emphasized that patients should not halt their medication without first consulting with their doctors. Most of the news stories featured this pronouncement very prominently. And at first glance, it sounded like one of those harmless, legalistic admonitions, like the notice on remedies for acid indigestion to consult your physician if symptoms persist. But in the context of a national press conference about two drugs that made people drop dead, the warning had a sensational effect. You see, it motivated tens of thousands of NCAID and Tambacor patients to telephone their doctors immediately. And no matter how politely and tentatively a patient might put it, the message had to be, why have you been giving me a drug that might kill me? So as local newspaper reports around the country indicated, that this created anger and chaos in the marketplace. And although the story died after a day or two in the national press, many local newspapers and medical publications covered the patient and physician reaction long after the initial press conference. Physicians have been angry about the news coverage of the cardiac arrhythmia suppression trial. That's CAST, cardiac arrhythmia suppression trial. And they reported that in the Medical World News in Detroit, cardiologist Felix Rogers told the Free Press there, "We have received a phone call from probably every patient who is taking either of these two medications." In Iowa, one cardiology group in Des Moines reported 100 phone calls the first day. It was no more tranquil in Florida. One doctor reported, "It's a mess. There are so many people on these drugs, it's unbelievable." That's what cardiologist Scott Pollock told the Orlando Sentinel. Down in West Palm Beach, Florida, cardiologist Robert Chake told the local daily paper, "This is the most irresponsible thing to have done, to let the media know about it before the physicians. It's like shouting fire in a crowded theater." Now, to Chait's kind of complaint, the Food and Drug Administration had a simple enough response. The spokesman, Bill Grigg, told one newspaper, "Listen, if you have something that's killing people, you can't get the information out there quickly enough, can you?" In short, he was saying, there really is a fire in this theater. Now, a sampling of how physicians handled the patient calls can also be seen through the local and medical press coverage. One response was the classic physician assurance. It goes like this. "These two drugs are very, very good drugs. Not perfect drugs, but basically very good drugs," said Jacksonville cardiologist Scott Baker. And he went on to say, "If you select patients for the drug carefully, you're not going to have problems." Well, out in California, Ronald Miller told the San Diego Tribune he did not intend to take any of his patients off of Tambacor or NCAID, but would schedule appointments anyway just to put their minds at ease. Now, some doctors switched to other drugs in the same family. Ramuel Elighetti told the Ocala Star-Banner that he was going to use Mexotil and Tonicard. In Des Moines, Chad Williams told the Des Moines Register personally, "If there's an alternative drug, I'm going to switch my patients onto them." Other physicians seemed oblivious to the message of CAST. At least, they appeared to be oblivious in their published comments. Now, one important lesson that we learned from the CAST test was the danger of physicians using drugs for purposes that were unproven and therefore yet unapproved by the FDA. Let me interject something here. Did you know that your doctor might be using these drugs to experiment on you to see how it's going to work in your case? Now, you know, in most people's cases, they're sick to start with, and then your doctor says, "Well, I don't know what to do, but let's try this." Do you know what "let's try this"? Let's try this new medication. That's an experiment, boys and girls, and your doctor is called a practicing physician, and he's practicing on you. So if you thought your doctor knew what he was doing, oh no, that's why we call them practitioners. They don't know what they're doing. They're practicing until they get better, until they learn how. And of course, they've got to have something to practice on, don't they? Now, one doctor wrote the FDA commissioner, Frank Young. He said, "I have received approximately 20 distress calls from patients and an equal number from equally distressed referring physicians and colleagues." In the next paragraph, he told Young that he was mainly using the drugs for an unapproved use for which no safety data was yet available. For rhythm disorders of the atria, the two small upper chambers of the heart. Well, the FDA advice runs counter to our experience, he concluded. Based on the same kind of uncontrolled patient experience, Tambacor had seemed equally safe to Joel Morgenroth and numerous other experts who had touted it for suppressing premature ventricular beats. Now, notice they use the word experts here. These are doctors. These are people with PhDs. These are pharmacologists. These are big multinational drug companies. They're called the experts. We had experts giving us thalidomide back in 1958, remember? The drug that caused all of the birth defects. Hey, listen, those were experts that put that drug out on the market. And you know this Vioxx story that you hear about more recently today, that was put out by experts and promoted by Dorothy Hamill. I always wonder, though, what does an ice skater know about a drug anyway? Well, because Dorothy Hamill is skating across the ice, and she's acting like a fairy, and she says, oh, I feel so good. Hell, you can get that from Joe down on the corner. He'll give you a drug that'll make you feel oh so good. That's what witchcraft's all about. It's to make you feel oh so good. That's why we take drugs. That's why we practice witchcraft. Well, in Florida, the Orlando Sentinel quoted one cardiologist as saying, the drugs have been very effective in treating atrial arrhythmias with very few side effects. And he told the paper that he may decide to keep those patients on the medication, in spite of the warnings. The fact that Tamiflu had been proven lethally dangerous in one mild rhythm disturbance did not deter this doctor from continuing the drug in other mild rhythm disturbances in a setting where safety had not been established. Well, still another doctor told the San Diego Tribune that no indication was found of danger for the many arrhythmia patients who have never had heart attacks. And yet, CAST had not found heart attack survivors uniquely vulnerable. They were simply the only patients who happened to be included in the study. Well, others attack, these are other doctors now attack this new restriction on these two drugs. An angry Idaho cardiologist wrote Young saying, this knee-jerk response of withdrawing the indication for Tamiflu and NCADE in the treatment of patients with ventricular premature beats of other than a life-threatening nature makes no scientific sense at all and does nothing but promote hysteria among patients who have been safely taking this drug all along. Let me pause here for a minute. If it doesn't kill you, then you've been taking the drug safely all along. The drug never killed everybody. It just killed six times more than would die if you weren't taking it. That's all. It's kind of like taking poison, you know, slowly. We do that every day. You know, we breathe polluted air and we drink water with fluorine in it and chlorine in it. And it doesn't kill us right away. It kills us over a long period of time. And it doesn't kill everybody. It just kills a higher percentage than those that don't drink polluted water. That's all. Well, the American medical system is no more of a monolith than any other system. Despite this massive outpouring of physician denial, some doctors actually saw the truth, and they saw it with icy clarity. Princeton cardiologist John F. Hageman wrote to the Food and Drug Administration, he said, as a cardiologist, what I find so offensive about these two drugs is that they are and they were recommended by the drug companies for the treatment of potentially life-threatening arrhythmias, namely PVCs. And the drugs turn out to be more dangerous than the placebo. Now, what greatly offended me about the advertising of these two companies involved was the use of the term potentially lethal rhythms. In fact, what we were dealing with was a potentially lethal drug. And in Youngstown, Ohio, cardiologist Paul Wright also saw the bigger picture. The Youngstown Vindicator quoted him saying, there were substantial risks associated with all of the drugs used to control irregular heartbeats, not just the two mentioned in the study. Wright evinced no anger about the enormous number of calls that he received. What we're faced with appears to be a competent study which says that drugs may be detrimental to some patients in some cases beyond what we thought. This information is new to us and will necessitate educating the public about them. Well, I think that we all ought to take a good, hard, long look at this whole concept of taking drugs. Now, God wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat when he prohibited this practice of witchcraft. Now, witchcraft takes about 20 different forms. We have different names. We call them diviners and mediums and necromancers and apothecaries and so on. But the practice has a lethal side effect. Smoking is a methodology that we employ to transfer nicotine in large quantities into our body so that we can experience a high. I smoked for 9 years, and I enjoyed every puff. People don't smoke because it hurts. People smoke because it feels good. You know, we don't go out here and practice adultery because it hurts. We practice adultery because it feels good. People aren't out here licking up crack cocaine because it hurts. It feels good. We do these things because it feels good. There's a benefit to it. We like it. Unfortunately, some of these things kill us. Adultery kills. Adultery causes things like AIDS, herpes, and VD. So God came along and he said, now listen, boys and girls, let me explain this to you. Thou shalt not commit adultery. It wasn't because he wanted to interrupt your pleasure senses. He wanted to interrupt death. The same thing is true here with drugs. Now, in the olden days, back in the Middle Ages, you know, people were experimenting, and they would take things like cocoa leaves and they'd cook them down, or they'd take poppies. You know, people have been taking heroin, you know, for thousands of years. You know, Sherlock Holmes was a drug addict. And people throughout history have been drug addicts. So this concept of using heroin, or, you know, we call it heroin today, used to be called opium, or smoking opium, you know, the Chinese used to smoke opium, and in the Middle East, you know, they smoke hashish. That's witchcraft. And this witchcraft used to be practiced not by Americans, not by Israelites. We used to look at these Chinese and these Arabs and say, oh my God, look at these people, they practice witchcraft. You know, it was 150 or 200 years ago, but we could see that. But we didn't outlaw these compounds or these drugs, because in Genesis 1, verses 28 and 29, God said, I have given you every green herb. That includes heroin, opium, poppies. That includes marijuana and cocoa leaves and tobacco plants. They're all green. And in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, they're called medicine. And the properties of these, when used in their natural form as foods, are actually beneficial to you. It's when we practice this art of the apothecary, it's when we take that tobacco plant and we synthesize this product down so that we can mainline this nicotine, that's what becomes witchcraft. That's what becomes deadly. In fact, when you smoke a cigarette today, it isn't just the nicotine. In fact, the Indians over here were smoking tobacco, you know, for a long time. It's where we learned it. We didn't just develop this. We came over here and learned it from the pagans in the New World, and we took it back to Europe with us. And I guess we really liked it, because we've been practicing that form of witchcraft for several hundred years now. So just keep in mind that when God told us not to practice witchcraft, it wasn't because he was taking away from us or insisted that we be vegetarians or that we not have medicines. But the synthesizing of this stuff down into these potent chemical compounds that we now call drugs is a killer. Sex isn't bad for you, boys and girls, but adultery is. Herbs aren't bad for you, but drugs are. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We'll have to break it off right there. We'll be back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, to tell you a little more. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools in all. And the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events. We do it 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's my signal. It says I gotta go. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.